Leaving land, oh, leaving land. Take your burden to the Lord and leave it there. If you will trust him and never doubt, he will surely bring you out. Take your burden to the Lord and leave it there.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Fretboard Journal's 126th podcast. I am Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal. The music you're hearing in the background is by Washington Phillips, the mysterious, amazing gospel blues singer who recorded in the 1920s and has mystified a bunch of us ever since. Today I'm talking to the stellar writer Michael Corcoran, who has devoted quite a bit of time and research into figuring out just who Washington Phillips was, what he played. As you can probably guess, that is no guitar, and what his life was like beyond the music. The result of his effort has provided the liner notes for the amazing Dust to Digital set Washington Phillips and His Mandarin Dreams, and if you're like me, and you're looking for some great holiday gifts to give away this season, I cannot recommend it enough. Last week we talked to a bass player on the Fretboard Journal podcast. This week we're talking about someone who played a handmade instrument with no frets, but no, we are not losing our touch. Phillips' music has resonated with a lot of guitarists, including Ry Cooder, over the years. So I hope you enjoy our conversation. We'll be getting back on track with the six-string stuff next week with a vintage Gibson acoustic panel that was recorded at the Fretboard Summit. We also have an episode with T. Drew Heinonen wrapping up the Fretboard Summit guitar build coming up. If you haven't subscribed to the Fretboard Journal podcast on iTunes yet, I hope you will leave us a review as well. And I want to give a huge thanks to folks from around the world who've been ordering from us ever since the Black Friday, Cyber Monday madness. And the orders keep coming in. We've got orders coming in from around the world. And as a reader-powered magazine, we appreciate all the support and all the new subscribers. Before we let Michael tell the story of Washington Phillips, we have one more shout-out to give out to our friends at TR Crandall. That's TRCRANDALL.com. They don't have any zithers or celestophones in their inventory, so you probably won't sound like Washington Phillips, but they do have some of the best Fenders, Gibsons, and Martins from the vintage days that you will ever find under one roof. They have an insanely cool TK Smith Sunburst electric mandolin for sale right now, and it is gorgeous and a work of art. I hope someone snatches it up and makes a little video with it. They also have Chris Eldridge Critters 1943 Gibson J45 for sale right now. So if you are looking for a banner guitar, you might want to head over there. Visit their website, visit their New York City store, and by all means, tell them the Fretboard Journal podcast sent you so they can keep doing these podcast plugs. And without further ado, here's Michael Corcoran from Texas walking us through the mythical, magical, amazing world of Washington Phillips. So Michael, you just released, I don't know whether to call it a book or a CD, Dust to Digital put it out. It is a work of art. It's all on Washington Phillips. And I would love for you to explain a little bit about how this project started and your relationship to his music.
Well, back in, I guess it all started when I got a CD in the mail called Amazing Gospel. And it was like a British compilation, you know, without any real liner notes or anything. It just had the music. And I'm sure they didn't even, you know, get clearances or licensing for it. They just put it out. And it was maybe about 15 gospel performers, old-timey. And Washington Phillips is the one that really stuck out in my mind when I heard it. It just sounded so unique to me. And so I kept that sort of in the back of my mind about this Washington Phillips guy. And one day I got a CD. I think I might have bought it, the Yazoo CD, around 2002. And I was reading in the liner notes, and it said that Washington Phillips died in Austin on the last day of 1938 of tuberculosis. He died in the mental institution. And so I went to my editors and I said, well, here's my local angle, you know, because I was working for the Austin American Statesman. You couldn't really spend a week on Washington Phillips. You know, you had to have a local angle.
Yeah.
So I said, look, this guy died in Austin here. You know, let me do a story on this guy. And they said, okay, sure. And so I spent about a week following up on the Washington Phillips who was in the liner notes and his parents. And I met with relatives and I drove up to Freestone County and spent about 3 or 4 days here, there, just interviewing people. And after a while, I realized that they had the wrong Washington Phillips, that everybody kept telling me, no, you mean my other cousin, Washington Phillips. He's the one that was a musician. And I'd correct them and go, no, it was the Washington Phillips that was married to a lector. And one day I was back home in Austin. I made a phone call and I talked to this guy named Virgil Keaton. He's an old black guy who was related to both of the Washington Phillips. They were cousins. And he said, no. And he told me the parents' names of the Washington Phillips, who was the musician. And so the next day I just got my car and drove to Freestone County. And, you know, having that added information, like the parents' names, made it easier for me to find his death certificate. And so once I found his death certificate, I was able to find out that he didn't die in 1938. He died in 1954. And also the date of birth and that sort of thing. So anyway, I did that article, and it got included in the DiCapo Best Music Writing of the Year for 2003. And I guess some people saw it from that, and Dustin Digital, they in their very first CD they put out was Goodbye Babylon. They had, I think, two Washington Phillips songs in there, and they cited, you know, my research that I had done. And so I guess Lance Ledbetter just had in the back of his mind to do a Washington Phillips thing at some point. So he contacted me in November 2013 and said, you know, is there anything new out there? You know, is it worth pursuing and doing more research on Washington Phillips? Because he wanted me to write, I think at the time it was 7,000 words. And, you know, this guy, really, when I started doing research, nobody knew anything about Washington Phillips at all. And every bit of biographical information that you see on him, it all came from my research. And so I wasn't sure that there was anything left, you know. But I said, well, just, I quoted him a price and basically just covered, you know, motels and gas. I said, yeah, let me go out there. I think there is some stuff. I did find something in the meantime, between the time the first article came out and Lance called me, I found an article in the 1907 Teague Chronicle, an article on Washington Phillips. And this is 1907, 20 years before he recorded.
Wow.
And it described his instrument that they said he made himself out of the, it was like violin strings in a box and that sort of thing. So he was already kind of tinkering around with the zither concept, you know, 20 years before he went in the studio. So anyway, I had that information, which was new. And I, you know, decided I would just go out there and see what I could find. And, you know, again, I spent a couple of days and just dug everywhere I could. I mean, no matter how slim the chances of finding anything, I still did it. You know, I looked in every single log. I went through every book in the county clerk's office pretty much. And I was able to piece together some information about who his grandfather was a slave from Kentucky who was sent to Texas in the 1850s, probably sold. And he had three sons, and two of the sons had sons named Washington Phillips, which was the grandfather's name. And anyway, I was able to go a little deeper in his past and was able to come up with the 7,000 words.
It's remarkable. And obviously for folks who are into the Fretboard Journal, you know, there are no frets in any of Washington Phillips' recordings, but there's always been this mystery about what he's playing. It used to be everyone, common knowledge was that he was playing, what, the Dulcineola? What was it called?
The Dulcineola. It was a piano-activated zither that was only around for 5 years, 1903 to 1908. And so, but from the 1907 article, we were able to ascertain that it was not a Dulcineola that he was playing, because it was not... no piano keys. He was strumming the chords. And so, yeah, that was another thing I was able to find out. Not only that they had the wrong Washington Phillips, but they had the wrong instrument. And, you know, because of Washington Phillips, that's the only reason anybody even knows about the Dulcineola this many years later.
Yeah.
You know, he's the only one he's it, you know. I think Lead Belly had a guy play a Dulcineola on one of his records in the 30s. But other than that, I think Ry Cooder thought that Washington Phillips played a Dulcineola, so he used a Dulcineola on a song too, but there's, you know, it all ended up being the wrong thing.
It's crazy. And do you want to try describing exactly what he had built in his own homebrew fashion?
Well, like I said, on the fretlesszithers.com, they really go into it really deep, but he had basically refashioned two fretless zithers with his own tuning, you know, his own strings. And, you know, that was basically it. I mean, people have tried, like Gary Harrison on fretlesszithers.com. had tried to recreate the Washington Phillips music with two zithers, and he was able to come close. But like you said, I think later on, it's like nobody could really do what Washington Phillips did.
Yeah. And do you feel like from all this research, I mean, you figured out who the right Washington Phillips is and when he died, but did you get any more insight into him as a human being and from his relatives or anything?
Yeah, I think, well, a lot of this has been made about him being a jackleg preacher, an unordained minister who went from church to church. And I was able to find out later in life that he was pretty much anchored to one church, the church that was closest to his house or his farm. And, you know, I was able to go out to the farm and spend some time there at night and just sort of see what he saw when he was creating the music. And, just a million stars in the sky. You know, it's so out in the country. It's the nearest town is like, 8 miles away, and it's a tiny town.
Yeah.
So I got in his mindset in a way, trying to think about what it would be like to be out in this area, making this music. But I think that there are a lot of huge gaps in my research. There's a lot of things that at some point I just had to give up. There's no way I'm going to find out for sure this or that. But I think talking to the townspeople from Simsboro, which was a freedman's community, it was all black, and that they all said he was very unique. He was weird, even was the word one of them used.
Sure.
Actually, they used peculiar. He used to coat his skin with liniment oil, and he drove around town in a with two mules, carrying a wagon, and he sold cane sugar and little remedies. He had a little bit of a witch doctor, sort of, not a witch doctor, but a little bit of a shaman-esque quality to him. But I don't know how much, that really adds. I was looking for anything I could find, and any little bit helped,
Yeah. Well, usually there's, when we think of obscure, weird blues and gospel, people think of the Paramount record label. What drew Columbia to him? Because how did that connection happen?
Well, Frank B. Walker, he's a major figure in the story of Washington Phillips. He was the executive at Columbia Records who started making road trips to the South. On earlier road trips, he discovered Gib Tanner and what's the guy's name? Riley Puckett.
Puckett, yeah.
Yeah, and some of the other people who recorded even before Washington Phillips. He discovered Bessie Smith, too. So as the popularity of the women blues singers was starting to wane a little bit, he started finding more like gospel blues type or blues people, really. And so he scheduled, because Texas is so hot and the lacquer would melt. I guess they didn't use lacquer, but what they use, shellac.
Yeah.
The shellac would melt. He scheduled trips to Dallas 3 Decembers in a row. And so what would happen is that he would set the word down. Dallas had a big Columbia headquarters. They had a three storefront, area there. And so he got the word out to everybody. We want the best musicians in the area. We're coming to town to record on December 2nd through 5th or whatever. And through the talent scouts, and I was never able to find any ads for it. So I think it was all word of mouth. So all these people like Blind Willie Johnson, he came for the same session. Washington Phillips, Lillian Glynn, Coley Jones, just on and on. And probably, 15 to 20 musicians showed up at this, basically to play music for this guy who's never heard him before. And so he had it all set up. It was also the first year that Columbia started using electric recording. And that's why I think that the sessions were at the Columbia headquarters in Dallas on Lamar Street. But anyway, Frank B. Walker just came in and he just wanted to hear all this music. And to me, it's just phenomenal when you listen to the Washington Phillips. The thing that I sometimes forget is that this is all one mic. This is a guy singing and playing, basically his audition is what was on record. And so to me, it's just amazing that Frankie Walker must have just been, flummoxed over what was happening.
Yeah.
That's kind of like where the misinformation about the instrument came, is that he originally called it a dulciola with a U, D-U-L, and because he thought it was more like a dulcimer, like a hammered dulcimer was what he was thinking. So he admitted that it was an instrument that Marshall Fields made himself and that nobody in the world could play it but him. And that's kind of where that came out. But I just think that Frankie Walker must have just been, blown away. Because then you've got Blind Willie Johnson in the same session doing Dark Was the Night, Cold Was the Ground, Motherless Children Have a Hard Time, Nobody's Fault But Mine, Jesus Make My Dying Bed. That's Bob Dylan, Led Zeppelin, Grateful Dead. All those songs, led to be, have this huge impact on music. And it was all done in one day in a little studio, a makeshift studio in Dallas.
Is the same day those were recorded?
Actually, no, it was not the same day, but the Blind Willie Johnson stuff was recorded the same day.
Wow. That's amazing.
He recorded six songs, and five of them are classics. I think I forgot, If I Had My Way, I'd Tear This Building Down. I'm not sure. My notes aren't in front of me, but five of the six songs he recorded that first day have ended up being classics.
Amazing.
And then Washington Phillips comes in the very next day and does the Nomination Blues, which, of course, Ry Cooter did in 1972 and sort of started a little bit of a revival for Washington Phillips back then.
Amazing. Michael, you are one of my favorite writers. Do you have any other wild goose chases you're going on with musicians that I should know about?
Well, I've done the Arizona Drains book CD. I've done the Washington Phillips book CD. I really think I need to do a little more on Blind Willie Johnson.
Yeah.
And so he's the last one. I've never done a book CD on him. I did do the liner notes for the Alligator Records tribute to Blind Willie Johnson. And that was only about 4,000 words. And I really, he's one of the major guys. I mean, I think he really was the first guitar hero. Him and Blind Lemon Jefferson.
Yeah.
Which is interesting that Blind Lemon Jefferson is from the same area as Washington Phillips, and they actually played together in a band before they all went solo.
Wow.
So there's that whole thing too. I mean, I think with the stuff I do, you just have to keep doing it. It's just like I compare it to like playing a slot machine or back in the old days when they had singles bars, before they had all these apps. Back then, the idea was that you just went out and you would ask women to dance or you would talk to women, and 90% of the time you would go home alone, but that 10%, it was made the other times worth it. And it's like that with what I do. You can get in the car and drive for 5 hours and you just find a little bit of information, but that's information that nobody ever had before, And the thing that I'm 61 years old and I've been a rock critic for 40 years, and I did the whole reviewing Janet Jackson concerts and all that crap, for years and years. But that's all disposable in my mind. What I'm working on now is stuff that's going to last forever. And I think that, 50 years from now, I can see people looking at my research on Washington Phillips, because really it was the primary research. And it's not because I'm just any great researcher, but I was the first one. Nobody really even thought to look into Washington Phillips. I mean, people wrote liner notes on CDs by Washington Phillips without doing any research. They basically just went online, I guess, or got someone to send them a death certificate on Washington Phillips, and they got the wrong guy, and then just built everything on that, And I think that going back to the biographical information, I think it is important to know that he lived until 1954 and wasn't the guy who was committed to the insane asylum, because his cousin Washington Phillips was committed in 1930, and a lot of people explained, that's why Washington Phillips stopped recording, because he was committed to the insane asylum. But that was his cousin. That was the wrong guy. The reason Washington Phillips stopped recording is because the Depression came. The stock market crash in 1929 pretty much dried up the demand. Records were 75 cents.
Yeah.
78 or 75 cents a piece. That was a lot of money. And some people, that was a full day's pay. And so after a while, it became more important to put food on the table than listen to records. And so that's what dried it up pretty much, not that he was committed.
Fascinating. The record is called Washington Phillips and His Mandarin Dreams. It's on Dusted Digital, and I've like many people who've obsessed over this guy, have several recordings of Washington Phillips, all the same kind of songs, but this is the keeper, I think, of the bunch for sure.
Well, I think that whoever did the remastering did a great job.
Yeah.
You know, I think it just sounds much clearer. You know, and sometimes when you get so into doing research on someone, you lose sight of what got you involved in the first place. And I think with this, one thing that this reissue has done for me is I put the CD in there, I listen to it, and I go, that's what got me going, was the music. I mean, this guy, it's like miraculous that he, you know, pretty much came fully formed out of the farm life in East Texas. You know, had no teaching at all, that's the mystery of Washington Phillips, is how did this guy who Gary Harrison called the height of rural originality, where did this come from? And that remains the mystery. I still don't know that. I could find out little biographical things here and there, like when he was born and where he lived, who he was married to, and that sort of thing. But you really will never know the motivation of the artist. You know, to me, he'll always remain a mystery to me.
Get back home, but remember Jesus.